Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this. It is the Rugby Dungeon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for doing all those things. Seldom has the Rugby Dungeon been so busy, but it's pretty busy tonight. We've got five people in here. And, well, I've not got my usual type of guest. In fact, I don't think it's going to be my usual type of podcast. So, hello, Craig. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, you?
Yeah, good. What do you think of our little setup this evening?
It's a great room. slightly getting used to cameras being in my face for the last couple of days, but no, it's good.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I've never had cameras here either. Well, no, we've got a small webcam. Which occasionally we leave running once we've finished and, you know, we talk about all sorts of things on YouTube that we shouldn't be talking about. But other than that, no, we don't often have cameras in here. So, yeah, it's a little bit weird. Why have these people been following you around for the last few days?
I'd like to say know the answer, but I don't. No. So, obviously, I've sort of had, like, some nominations through, some finalist things through, sort of, like, some awards for, obviously, like, sort of, Things that I've done over the last sort of few years. One, sporting excellence, for an award for sporting excellence. So obviously that covering sort of like my sport recovery journey, sort of to using that voice created through that recovery to sort of obviously like help other people. And then another one from the X Forces is in business, which is for Inspiration of the Year, which is based solely around sort of the stuff I've done with the Eastdale Sharks Trust, with the Forces project that we've got there and all the mental health stuff that we do too. So it's been because of that, I'm guessing.
We've been joined by these fine people.
Yeah, Channel Craig going on.
Tell me about the Sharks Forces Trust.
So the Sharks Forces side of the trust was a project sort of like got built. We're in our third year now, so we're like, so yeah, call it 2 years running. I got brought on not long after sort of returning from competing in Chicago. It's always like a standing joke within the team. Is that like sort of I was found in a park? It's quite true. I was found in a park, but I was doing a talk coming back from Chicago. I was doing a talk at a Disability and Inclusion Day, for Team UK and. Basically, the South Sharks Community Trust was there, and we got chatting, and then pretty much led to here. The Forces program, though, mainly hits the transition side of the military. Obviously, it helps through the rugby being one of the main sports in the army. Obviously, massively helps, and then using that and using the power of the South Sharks brand and stuff has sort of been massively influential in sort of helping them sort of guys transition. That's not meaning the lads transitioning who just got out. It means lads who have been out 20 years, 30 years, we're still making sure that like that they can transition. Obviously, transition is a term pretty much used quite loosely in terms of a lot of people think that you can transition straight away. Some people are just not ready to transition. And it's mainly about accepting who you was and working with who you was to become who you are. And that's pretty much the sort of message we sort of try and get out of Sharks Forces is, like, I was a very lost boy after leaving the military, and obviously a lot of issues and stuff. And I probably still am I'm still transitioning, but my transition has probably been a very random one. But it's no blueprint. But it's what I've done sort of seems to have worked. So it's not pushing that on everyone or trying to force that on everyone. But it's just using my knowledge and sort of what I've done to sort of help others. And that's through various social events. yeah, through various social events, whether that be tea or coffee mornings, days out, or the new thing which we've got on, which is every sort of like Tuesday morning at 7 a.m. and Thursday at 2, which is dog walking. Yeah. Which is just something simple, just to get active. So it's various things, but we can help with like housing. We've had lads who have been, we've had veterans who are homeless. We've helped get them into housing. We've had lads who have needed mental health help, and we've managed to sort of skip the queue and get them to the top of the queue by being who we are. We've got jobs for guys and girls who needed jobs, and more so, we've built a community, and I think that's probably been the important thing. Is when you get out, military is a bubble. You're very well protected. When that bubble pops, like, the world comes closing in, and sort of that's what we've managed to sort of get out of of everything. Is we've created a community that wasn't there. We filled that gap using rugby, and it's proved pretty popular. Well, we're in our third year now, so let's see how this sort of year rolls.
So I, you know, in the space of like 5 minutes, we've gone through an awful lot of stuff about what you do, and I'm pretty sure everyone listening is wondering, like, where on earth did you come from? So you're in the forces. You joined the army rather young, right? Did you come straight out of school into the army?
Yeah, so I sort of joined, started my application at like the world's youngest. I started it not long after sort of my 15th birthday. And then sort of obviously then I was 16 in the July, my first day in the army. I was 16 on the 12th of July, and my first day in the army was the 7th of September. So, yeah, I was, like, literally, like, a couple of months after being 16, so, yeah.
Would you have tried to get in earlier if you could?
If you could still lie for your age, like they used to in the olden days, and, yeah, I'd done anything to sort of get out of the situation. I did join just to get out of my situation, I think, was the main.
What was your situation?
So, I was from, like, sort of a bit of a broken home. Pretty much everyone from a council state is, though, so it is what it is. Obviously, you just deal with that card, like, it didn't faze me, not bothered by it. Like, my brothers were obviously quite heavily involved in sort of, like, the gang sort of culture, or should I say, like, wanting to be gangsters.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. Like, we always crack jokes in our family and say there's a Monaghan gene, where it makes us sort of that bit more robust, a bit more of a warrior, a bit more of a fighting man. I just wanted to put that into sort of great practice. And, like, my sister, she put it into practice. She's a nurse now, moved to Australia last month and stuff like that. So I just wanted to do something different, break that chain.
You're from a military family?
No, I'm not. My uncle that I'd never met was in the military, served in the Falklands, but that was the only link to the military. So it was sort of way out of my comfort zone. But
so when you joined up then, how was that initial experience? How did it differ from what you were used to?
A teacher shouted at me once in school when I was 15 years old, and I swung at him. and that's the fair to say, I never was allowed in geography again. But joining the army, like, I was sort of ready. I knew people were going to shout at me, and I knew I couldn't swing at them. So when the first person shouting at me was like on the first day, a massive guy, never seen a guy to this day. It's like, the only way I can describe it is like a.
Give me a Sharks player as a sort of.
That's what
reference.
I was thinking of, like a.
Val Mostoff or someone.
Like a Ross Harrison, but slightly taller, was probably what he looked like. And he's shouting at us because we were taking our time. And what we were taking our time doing was going to the shower. And he was so we rushed in, and this guy who's a really tall Ross Harrison, who stood naked, and we're all 16 years old, and he's teaching us how to wash, and he's literally screaming at us, talking about how brushing your teeth is tactics, and we'll keep you alive at war. And I'm thinking, if brushing my teeth is gonna keep me alive in war, then I'm good to go. Like, I can brush my teeth.
That's amazing. Yeah. So that idea of discipline. I mean. Was it that appealed to you, or was it just the fact that you're going to get some guns and?
No, it was the money. I'll be honest, it was the money. Like, my family, we never had money, sort of thing. And like, I can always remember, like, I was literally talking about it the other night. My first paycheck in the army was £666, and I remember thinking, I'm loaded, like I'm wedged. Thought I could move out the hood from it, like, like it generally was the money aspect, the fact that I could get away from. the area, get away from Wythenshawe. And I did sort of swear that I'd never come back to Wythenshawe until I could afford to buy somewhere. And like that was bang to its word. At 18 years old, I bought an apartment in Wythenshawe. And I'd say an apartment, it became a lad's pad, but that's a different story. But yeah.
Yeah. So what's the sort of first thing that you learn when you sign up? Because you signed up, before I go there, did you know you were going to join infantry, or did they tell you you're going to join the infantry?
So I walked in the careers office and was met by a Royal Logistics driver, Royal Logistics Corps driver, and his words were, "You want to join a logistics corps? Like, you get qualifications?" And I went, "Yeah." He's like, I think I said, "No, I've used Google once, and like, you just don't do anything." And he sort of took it really offence, and then the next thing they say, this lad who was like leaving the army, like from, I think it was a local regiment at the time, the Cheshire Regiment, they're called Mercians now. And he was like, "Oh, you want to join the infantry then? That's like what you want to do." And my aspect was, if I was going to be a soldier, like I was going to be a soldier, like I was going to go away and fight. No point in doing things in half. Like I strongly live by a saying which I still sort of live by now, and certainly which helped me. And it's like, moderation's for cowards. And what's the point in joining the army to be a guy that looks good in uniform, when you could be a guy that looks good in uniform but actually do his job? And that's pretty much the thing I did. So my response to him when he tried to get me to join his local regiment, which is nothing against them, obviously they've served in Afghan too, and like they've lost lads too and stuff, but I didn't want to be tied to a local area, and that's it.
And nothing concerned you about it?
I don't think I thought about it. Like I was the guy that wanted the big fight, wanted the war, and it's probably the empathy of a warrior. Like, you do want that fight, and you do want it at the highest caliber. And I always remember, like, if I could go back now, still would have joined the infantry. I probably wouldn't have wished on that fight. Like, that's just because obviously I did get the fight at the highest caliber, but I was well aware of the risk. Growing up where I lived, there was a lad across the road from me who, I don't know why I'm laughing, it's probably not a funny subject, who had joined the army, and he was a fighting man, he was infantry, he was in paras, and I got on really well. His dad was a firefighter who'd been in the paras and been in the Clinton, and this guy literally was just coming home all the time, and it sounds, and I don't mean it in like a bad way, but he had everything. He had like the nice car, he had women hanging off him, it was like, I was like, yeah, I wanted a bit of that life. And then he sort of went to Iraq, and then another lad from Wythenshawe, like Audley Ellis, as I was sort of going through my application, that like ultimately died. And that sort of did bring it a bit home to me. Like I'd never really met him. I knew his sister quite well, but I never really met Lee over and in passing when he was visiting or whatever and stuff. But that sort of, that was a sort of bit of a wake up call, like, this is for real, and it's not just about girls and nice cars and, but I still sort of wanted it still.
Do you get a sense of the seriousness of what you're going to do when you go through training?
Probably not. I know they try and put it in you, and you go on like this cheesy battlefield tour where you go and like look at Pegasus Bridge and stuff, which is all well and good. Obviously, that's a sacrifice that needed to be made at that point in life. But
where's Pegasus Bridge?
Normandy. So it's sort of like they fly you to Normandy for a week, and you try and settle in, like look about like the war sites and stuff. But everything's been so desensitised about World War II now, it sort of is like forgot about. It's just, you just look at them and think, oh, it's just, the phase will get used like about World War II. People just think old men and medals, that's all they think. They don't think about what actually they did. So I was ready for Afghan, like I was ready to fight, but I weren't aware of the reality of it until probably I stepped off the plane. When I stepped off the plane in Afghanistan, our plane was coming on, the plane next to us was the casualty plane.
Oh God!
So as I'm walking down the steps and walking across the tarmac to this van, I looked back and I literally seen bodies and of people getting loaded onto this flight, and sort of I'm like walking across like body armor open and my helmet in my hand, you know, like thinking I'm a lad now, like I'm at war, like I knew in a couple of days I was going to face the enemy and stuff, but like, these lads were having the worst day of their life, all turned up into the tidy knots, getting on a plane with legs missing, arms missing, whatever. You could hear him moaning and screaming, and that brought you home a little bit. That was probably a big wake-up call. And then, like, don't be wrong, I was a very serious soldier. Like, I was, some would say, like, I was tipped to sort of go on and do sort of great things. So then I had nothing at home, so the army was everything.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I put that effort in. And I was aggressive, and I was, like, I was the typical, what you'd expect from a lad growing up in Wythenshawe, like, but I just put it into a really good context in the military, and sort of that was probably the biggest wake up call and the biggest thing that made me think, right, this is real now, was probably that that probably instinct walking off that flight.
Did you have a feeling of invincibility when you were going through training?
Probably not through training, because the training team we had were all absolute animals. But certainly you do feel like you're the daddy when you are on leave, or you like you feel hard, you feel like no one can touch you. And I think that's probably why, if we refer back to like Sharks Forces, I think that's why that's so important, is in the army to survive, you have to have an ego and you have to be a big character.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the biggest thing that people worry about, is when you get out, you can't be have that ego. You can't be a big character. You've got to find where you fit in the pecking order in the army. You're told, like I used to walk through camp and people would shout, "Don't look at these lads, like, because you're the best." Like, that's what people would think. Like, we were the empathy, like.
How do you mean?
So, like, literally, like, support arms weren't allowed to sort of, like, look at us. Like, our corporals would shout at them, "Don't look at them, you're not good enough to look at these." And if
they did look?
They'd get shouted at, like, told to look away and stuff. That sort of, you fed that massive ego that like, nothing can hurt you, and, like, and you have to be. You know what I mean? Like, I spent, up until the point I got injured, like, I spent 4.5 months with over 217 firefights, like,
how many?
270. I was a weirdo and took a tally sheet out of every incident I was in.
Wow.
Which is what we use on the thing. So that's probably why it's important that something like Sharks Forces is there, because that when that comes crashing down, you can't walk into Civvy Street with that ego. A, you ain't going to get a job, and B, you'll just get flattened, like, on the outside. And that's pretty much where we do. We pick up the pieces there and rebuild them.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you put it like that, because I guess you don't have that, you know, that support or your mates or... Yeah, it must be a one hell of a reality shock, actually, when you come into what feels like a fairly soft world. And actually, it's, you know, it's pretty brutal, just in different ways.
Yeah, yeah, very, like, in the army, you know what you're getting. You know every 6 months you're probably going to deploy. You know for 4 out of them 6 months you're probably going to be working. And your money's your own, and you've not really got responsibility. Yeah, the whole country relies on you, and you're in theory, you're the hammer to be thrown. It got described to me a perfect way is... And it was described to me by a priest. My job was to take things. So, in that, my job was to take things. When democracy failed, I was there to go and take it back. That was my job. Like, was, if that isn't working out, you're going to go, you're going to be violent, and you're going to take what's ours. And that was pretty much all. So, if you look at how simple my life was, I'd get up in the morning, I'd train to take something back, and then I'd go to bed at night. And then all of a sudden, I came home, and one of the things I constantly referred to is, I lived in an apartment when I left the military, and The newest lad in the block in the military will take your rubbish out. I lived in this apartment. I put my rubbish outside my door. Came out 3 days later, and the bag was still there. And I was fuming. why is my bag still there?
Yeah.
Like, and one of the things, like, it was quite common. Obviously, it's no secret. Obviously, like, I got wounded, so obviously you get quite large payouts and whatnot and stuff. And I always remember probably a pinnacle point. It's quite public, you know. I had over £250,000 in the bank, but I didn't know how to pay a bill.
Wow.
Like, I never knew how to pay a bill. A guy knocked on my door once and he was like, "Oh, you've not paid your electric, we're going to cut you off." And I was like, "No, I've got money, mate." And he's like, "It's not the point, you've got this." And I generally didn't know. Like, I generally didn't understand how to pay a bill. And that's probably why, we're going into Berwyn Prison in April, to help with soldiers who've ended up, for whatever reason, ended up in prison. And one of the biggest things we put in that is financial budgeting.
Yeah.
Because that's, I didn't know how to pay a bill when I got out, and that's why, so this course that we've created is to put that, is to teach them how to pay bills, and like as an education pack, is to sort of bring them out, and so they come out and they don't have them issues. Like,
It's these really weird sort of day-to-day things that people don't understand people need. You take it for granted. Bill paying, basic literacy, you know, being able to read a bus timetable, just weird things like that.
And that's the biggest thing. Where we just had literally an incident in the trust at the minute is, while we're writing this booklet for this prison, obviously I need to write it because it's based on my experience, based on experiences of lads leaving the military and coming out. Now, I passed it to the community development manager, Vicky, and she literally looked at it and went, "Craig, what is this?" And I was like, "Oh, I wrote it." And it's, in the military, we have our own language. We speak differently. We speak in a lingo. We speak in stupid ways. And we obviously everything's short and like everything's done at 1,000 miles an hour in the military. So your language is at 1,000 miles per hour, and you could sit four veterans in this room and you probably won't even understand what we're saying. But I literally wrote it as if I was in a conversation on this book, and the whole thing literally had to be changed. Not the content, but the way everything was worded had to be put into a civilian context.
Which is weird, because you're actually going to give it to ex-military people.
Yeah, yeah, but that's, we're trying to break that chain, and that's why it needs to be like that.
Of course it does.
So even I'm still learning, and I've been out for a good few years now.
Mm. So just give me a bit of a taste of, you know, what it is like when you land in a place like Afghanistan, because that can't be like anything else that you've ever experienced.
So it's like, I'd say it's like, I like to say the shock of capture, but obviously no one's probably really had the shock of capture. So it's like,
have you had the shock of capture?
I've never been captured, no, but like you obviously train for stuff like that, and there's times where you're like, you don't want to do something. So the only way I could describe it is, imagine walking out your front door now and being told, walk to the AJ Bell Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
You can't imagine doing it. Or you can imagine it taking a very long time. That's what Afghan was. You couldn't imagine it. Like, the feeling, you couldn't imagine it.
What was it like with you and your mates? Did you fly out of Bryce?
So we flew out of Bryce. So we flew from... We weirdly flew from Belfast International. It is Belfast International Airport. Belfast International Airport to Bryce Norton, because we were based in Ireland.
Okay. At this point, it's important to say that you were with the Rifles.
Yeah. And then from Bryce, we had a quick stop in Egypt for like 2 or 3 hours. We seen the pyramids from the plane, and we actually stood at the door for some fresh air. And then we sort of like, then you fly into Kandahar. We had delays between Egypt and Kandahar, which meant that we couldn't fly straight onto Bastion. You land in Kandahar and like, didn't have a shock and all then really. Like, and like, other than the casualty thing at the start, I woke up and we got put in these like tents on the side of the airfield, and then there was like, there was no one there. You got told that if you wear a siren, put your body armour on. Didn't really sort of realise. The next day, I literally went up and I got up and we got told, yeah, go for breakfast. I walked in this place and there was like loads of Canadian and American soldiers, and they're eating steak and drinking Fanta. And I was like, this is what war's like. This is, like, I'm down with this. It's just like being in Mali with the boys. And that's pretty much what I thought originally. And then that afternoon, we went for a coffee at Tim Hortons, middle of a battlefield, having coffee in Tim Hortons. It was the most surreal thing. And obviously, like, Kandahar province, like, Kandahar and the areas around it were having these problems, but it was nothing on the scale of what we were about to go to. So we left there, went to Bastion. When we landed in Bastion, the first sight I seen was these special forces operators coming off a helicopter, and they just looked drained. I've never seen guys like it. They all looked like, wow. They all looked like they'd not ate, and, like, they literally had, like, blood on them. You could see they were just dragging the kit. They weren't even carrying it. They were dragging it across the floor, and I was like, it's heavy, that, like, and then I'm like fresh face, like I have a picture where I'm pretty fresh face. I've shaved my head, cause it's like you're not gonna get an haircut now. And then you flash forward three months, and I'm skinny, and I've got long hair, and you can see like lives look like it's drained out of me and stuff. So that's sort of like the first sort of day, and then you go into sort of some briefs, and the briefs are valid. Don't get me wrong, the briefs are valid, and they are very good, and that. But for example, like, the war at that point was changing every single day. And we were told, like, things like, right, anything below a 7 on your metal detector, for example, was not an IED.
Below 7?
Yeah, anything below a 7.
So just tell me a little bit about how that... Sorry to interrupt. Tell me a little bit how that works, then. You've got
You have a metal detector, a guy at the front who's called a Fallon man, and then you'd have a cover man, which I was the guy at second. His job is basically, his sole job is his weapons over his shoulder. His sole job is just look at that floor and that metal detector and wait for something to beep or go bang. As horrible as that sounds, that's pretty much it.
And then everybody stops.
Then he gets a BP, goes down onto his belt buckle, so he lies down flat, crawls up to the thing that's just double-toned. I go up on my knee, so I'm on one knee between his legs as his cover, just in case the Taliban take a quick snipe. And he's confirming with his hands, so he's pulling back the sand to see whether there's a bomb under there while I'm covering him. And then if it is one, we mark it, go around it, or we wait for the OD, probably mark it and go around it. Just for, obviously, your aim's to win a war. It's not to clean up after people. So you do that. And we at the start of the war, no ID in Afghanistan had gone off that's below a 7 tone. Out of 14 tones, a 7 was the lowest anyone had registered. Our first lad killed was killed of a 2 tone. We'd had to adjust. We knew they were there. We adjusted. Basically, we had a very good platoon sergeant who he was like on his 9th tour, and he was like, "Look, like I get what they say, like, but don't listen to them. Like they're going off things that happened 6 months ago. At war, six months in a war list, that's moving this quick. It's like 2 lifetimes.
So if you're going from like point A to point B, you must be stopping every 3-4 minutes.
Yeah, at one point I have a picture which is currently in Carrington at the minute on my side from some other reason, and where there's in the picture we're fighting, we're crawling up on a place with 14 IEDs marked around us, and we're just moving in and out like it. So some days it was good, some days it wasn't. Like it is what it is though. Like
so they must have been going back and then planting more IEDs where
they would wait till one went off, and then they knew you had in war. Someone dies, it's classed as a murder, so they have to send a team to investigate it.
Oh.
So what they do is, when they send that team in the actual crater that's been created by that blast, they'll plant another ID inside that crater in aim to get the other guy that's coming in. So in the end, we just had to change everything about it. But the biggest thing was, if sometimes, it's horrible to say, but IDs in Afghanistan were only taking legs or lives. They weren't hit, like, they weren't not doing anything else. So they had to come up with a better idea, so they'd stick them in walls at head height or stuff. So what was just checking the floor, you were now checking the walls. So the movement became 100 metres every 10 minutes to 100 metres every hour.
Oh, my God.
So what happened then was pretty much your sort of area of operation just shrunk.
Yeah.
Shrunk, and the Taliban sort of pretty much cut us off. And at one point, we were cut off with what was like, probably we had enough ammunition to last us 15 minutes if the Taliban gave us a good scrap. Like, it is what it is, like... Go back to that. You want it at the highest caliber. Like, you want to be cut off and you want to be surrounded, because, like, I'm not paid to lose. I weren't paid to lose. Like, and that's one thing. Like, sort of moving forward, I've always said, like, my ability to win. Like, me and you are walking to a coffee machine. Like, I'm going to beat you to it. Like, that's my mentality, and that was what it was then, as it is now.
Crikey, you said that at the end of it, you started to lose weight. I mean, is that just from like a calorie deficit, or is that stress?
We were probably hitting about one meal a day in Afghan. Some days we didn't eat, some days we did. Well, probably about one meal, about 1,000 calories, probably a meal.
1,000 calories a day, yeah. And I get stressed if I miss breakfast.
Don't get me wrong, I eat loads now. Like, me and Vicky and that, we'll all go to eat, like, Yo Sushi about a billion times a week. Like, we'll eat loads now, but that's probably why I do.
That's unbelievable.
One of the biggest issues we had was DMV would come around probably every 5-6 days.
Okay.
And then...
Diarrhea, vomiting.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You won't be able to get rid of that. Like, Afghans are just a dirty country. Like, you've not got showers, so you can't shower. You're baby wiping at best. You're drinking water that's been found in a well, and you just purifying it. And at times, the Taliban would throw stuff in the well, so you couldn't drink that water. And then you're not eating. And if you, like, it's not like you're going to shoot a local cow. Like, you've got to pay him for it. But the weirdest thing about Afghan is, in all that, you could give a local villager $10 and they'd bring you back a crate of Coca-Cola. It's the weirdest thing ever. Like, but yeah, so you sort of, like, you're not eating. All that's going on. DMV would come around quite regularly.
So
our nourishment was probably the biggest problem we faced over in ourselves. Over
I can't
in
believe
enemy.
That.
Yeah, it's not the army's fault though. Like, that's what a lot of people blame the army. It's not their fault. Like,
it's just the reality
of
the situation.
It's just the reality of war. War is hell, and it's meant to be. But you train for that. You know what hunger is before you go out there. And don't be wrong, like...
Do you train for that? I mean, did you ever train on, like, 1,000 calories a day for extended
period? You train on, like, based on ration packs. But, no, you can't predict what war is like, but you try and recreate that stress back home. And I think that's probably the big thing is, when you're back home and you're trying to recreate that stress... You don't know hunger until you lay in a ditch in Afghanistan surrounded by the enemy, and all of a sudden your belly rumbles. It's well weird. But but you can't train for that. But what you can train is to be fatigued like that.
Yeah.
Like, and you'll just go, like, you'll go days without sleep training for it. Like, I slept more in the opening days of my war in Afghan than I did in the pre-deployment training. But I needed that because I knew what tired was. I knew what hunger was. I knew what my body was showing. I knew my body's limit. Like, and the biggest thing about Afghan was it tested every angle of my limit, and I knew where my limit were.
So how frequently were you fighting a war, either ill, DMV, or just, I mean, was it like every six, well, he said every 6 days, I guess.
I remember lads walking out the gate, throwing up minutes before they went out the gate to fight, like. And don't be wrong, if they were proper, like, DMV man down, like, then they're not going out on the ground. But soldiers have pride. If your brothers, like, are fighting, like, you don't want to sort of let them down. Like, for my biggest fear would be being in a tent poorly just because I'm throwing up a little bit.
And for you, that would be worse, thinking that you're in that tent than not.
Yeah, like, if my brother was killed while he was out on a tracker and I'm laying in a tent throwing up, like, I wouldn't be able to live with myself with that. I'd rather be throwing up than sort of that, like.
Did it give you an appreciation for, you know, the other trades in the army? Like, do you know when we were saying,
no, like you become to hate them a bit more.
Really? So like legit.
Yeah, it's just they'll look at you smugly when you come back. So like before we went on to Panther's Claw, we closed one fob down, which is dead weird. It was a sort of funny story though. Like when we closed,
so fob is forward operating base.
Yeah, yeah. So when we shut this place called Forward Operating Base Gibraltar down, the lad who lived across the road from me growing up got injured in that forward operating base. So it was, I was growing up with this lad and he got hit in Afghan a year, and then a year later I was shutting that place down. So it's dead weird. I've got a picture of me in the tent where he got hit, like, so it's sort of surreal. Like, and we talk about it a little bit but we just acknowledged each other's fight, like, and it's quite brazen. Like, the guy's come onto the Sharks Forces project recently and he's now, like, progressed on, he's out and stuff like that, and he's came on the Sharks Forces project, he's come to a few events and stuff, and he doesn't talk about it, I don't talk about it, we just acknowledge each other with a little smile.
You just know.
Yeah, we don't need to speak about that. So sort of when we go back to that support arms thing, is you come back into Bastion, and we came back we shut Jib down, we went and we were about to go into Sangin, and we had 3 days, and we came off the helicopter, and the first guy, we basically rushed back to our tent, had our weapons took off us, so, and told, like, you've got 3 days, like, chill out, like, you've earned it, we've just been fighting, you've earned your 3 days.
And what do you do in your 3 days?
We rushed a Pizza Hut and got told to go back to our tents and get changed by a supporting arms sergeant major who said, yous are too dirty and yous have not shaved. And one of our lads went, do you realise, like, literally, like, 2 days ago, like, my platoon commander was killed. Like, I've literally just come in, I'm on a quick turnaround, then back out in 3 days. Pizza Hut shuts in half an hour. And he went, and his words literally were, I don't care.
Oh,
and
my
so
word.
So then you obviously instantly get angry. You got military police doing people for speeding in Bastion. Like, bearing in mind, there's a war going on outside that gate, and they just don't take that appreciation, which is sort of funny. So I've just said recently, like, I've never put all that going on. 9,000 soldiers every 6 months cycle through Afghan. 1,500 probably see the front line. 200 probably see the enemy. I've never met a guy who's never fired his weapon in Afghan, which is sort of strange. So them support arms, like, they all want to be you. Like, and because obviously that's why they're all still talking about how they fired their weapon. But really, the majority of them just did people for speeding tickets and uniform issues in Bastion and didn't do nothing. So as you can see, the pain's still there, really bad.
But, I mean, it does sort of highlight something. I mean, like, you know, you were sort of saying then, you know, there are different levels of military, what you're doing and then the supporting arms. But then I guess it's exactly the same problems when you land here, because, you know, I could be talking to you, you're just a normal bloke, you're down the river club. I have no idea what you've been through, and therefore I can't really...
Personally, for me, I like that. So one of the biggest kicks I get probably is I like the fact that I can walk in a coffee shop and no one knows my story. Don't be wrong, it's the more attention it's getting sort of harder, certainly around sort of the rugby-dominated areas.
Yeah.
But I find a peace in the fact that not everyone knows that. Like, I don't want to be seen as, oh, that's that guy who's done that or that. And I only want to be known for that if it's helping someone.
Yeah.
And that's...
But I guess my point would be on that is it's in the same way that a supporting arms sergeant wasn't able to empathise with what you've been through and therefore was, frankly, a bit of a dick. Yeah. I mean, you must come out and think everyone's a bit of a dick because just they don't have any idea.
Yeah, and you're fine when you, like... So a lot of the veterans we deal with on, like, Sharks Forces are fighting men. Like, they tend to be the sort of the lads who have been away and fought, whether that be from Falklands or Kosovo or Bosnia or the first Gulf, Iraq or Afghan. And you'll find the issues they have, the issues they face, are like my incident in Afghanistan where we were told we were not clean enough and we're not shaved. That's what, and they come out and like, oh, he's a bit of an idiot or whatever. The issues them lads are facing is that exact issue, just on the outside. Is no one emphasizes with what they've done. And I've always saying what we try and get into the soldier is, yeah, you've been to war, but ultimately on the outside, the appreciation's not there, and they need to realize that. And yeah.
I mean, maybe it is if they knew, but people don't want to say, hey, I am, you know, I am this.
So
or
if
I am
you
that.
Take Northern Ireland for example, so. You take Northern Ireland and the Metropolitan Police. When Northern Ireland was going on, 85% of the Metropolitan Police were Northern Ireland veterans, because Northern Ireland taught soldiers a lot. It taught them how to be diligent. It taught them respect. It taught them, like, you can't judge every single person. It taught them a lot. Metropolitan Police now has 22% ex-Iraq and Afghan veterans. So that's a massive drop. The reason that's dropped there is, gone are the days now where we're doing operations like Northern Ireland. If something gets off in Ireland now, you'd have real big problems, because the lads now are not trained like that. They're not trained. They're trained to be aggressors, not peaceful soldiers.
I understand.
So that's filtering down a lot into sort of employment. So you take that as an example. A lot of employment lads don't want Iraq and Afghanistan. So what we're doing now, Sharks Forces wise, is we're telling them to change the way the army are telling them to do their CVs. And that's the army will tell you, put your operations on there, put this on there, put how you've commanded men.
Do not do that.
And I just say, no, don't do that. Like, if you manage blokes, you change it from, I led a section into battle, which was generally what I had on someone's TV, to I manage men.
Do you think there's an element of society changing, though? Like, society getting, I'm not going to say softer, that isn't what I mean, but you know, they value different things.
I think, it's a tough question. I wouldn't say it's softer. I'd say they're just not. Even though we've got things like social media and stuff like that, I think the world's just very desensitised to what people are doing. And people don't appreciate that sacrifice probably as much. And I think that's probably where more problems are coming. Like, certainly we're finding through the project, there seems to be a lot more, even in the space of a year. You could get four new people, and then four new people have the most complex issues ever. And it's because they just don't feel accepted by society anymore. You just feel like, don't be wrong, I sometimes feel like that. Like, it's just, that's just the way things are now.
Yeah, it must be completely alien. So, you said you were in over 200 firefights.
Yeah, so we're, like, that's not like all massive firefights. Some of them are just like a little fighter popping his head around the corner, whacking a little spray of bullets at you,
now,
running off.
A good friend of mine is fireman. And he just says, like, there's no, like, telltale signs of something going on, but he just feels that there might be something wrong with the situation. He can sort of, like, feel the heat in the air, or there's just something. Was there anything which could kind of set off that sixth sense of,
yeah,
like, something's going to go off?
Yeah, it literally is. Certainly, sort of, I never believed like fighting men when he used to say, oh, you'll know when something's about to kick off. Right? I remember a firefight where we're walking through this field, Poppy's literally taller than me. And all of a sudden, like, it's like the world just became calm, like everything slowed down. I swear, like, even when I think back to it now, it's like the poppies even started swaying in the wind slower, and it was like the next thing I knew, it was the Afghan national soldier that was in front of me was the weirdest change. He went from carrying his weapon over his shoulder to all of a sudden he had it holding it properly, and I was like, how did he, like, my instinct was like, how did he know? And he took two more steps and the whole world erupted around us, and they were in the same field. The Taliban were in the same field as us.
Crikey.
And it, but at that moment, it was like you sensed the world slow down and it comes. So if you take that into a sort of a civilian context, when I came, when I got out of hospital, I went to a petrol station once at like 2 a.m., pulled onto the petrol station floor, and there was two cars, one on the side and one behind me, packed with lads. And like, not that I fear any, like, I don't fear anyone, like, and obviously, I've just come back from Afghan, like, I'm definitely not going to fear some lads in a car. He let on to me as I pulled down, got out of my car, and I went to start filling up, and I just made eye contact with one of them. And he didn't look at me, he smiled, like, he just sort of, like, let on, like, acknowledged me, and something just didn't feel right, and I sort of, like, so I just put the petrol can on, got on, drove off. As I got to the bottom of the road, police are flying past me, so naturally, you just turn around, don't you? Oh, are the police there, like, curious. They just held up. They were currently holding up the petrol station.
Oh my god!
The guy hit the button.
Where was that?
It was on the parkway.
Oh, Princess Parkway. Oh, I know. Yeah.
So it was like just that. Like, so that does go into certain elements. But then with the injury, sort of, I have like sort of a brain injury wise, it can all be overwhelming. Like, you could have a you could be having a conversation with someone and I'd not even hear my name, and naturally I'd think you're talking about me, like, in a bad way. And it's,
yeah.
So it does get, it's a broad spectrum, but certainly in the battlefield, like, there is something there. And when I talk to police, fire brigade, they all seem to have sort of the same thing. And when you talk to the veterans on the programme there, they still rate, they have it, like, and I suppose, though, you do know when, you know.
Like, yeah, like, it must be, like, tiny little changes to your environment, or something which you can't really describe, but you can register it.
Yeah.
So you finally get injured after, well, a lot of active service. Do you remember the morning before you went on patrol? Sorry, I say patrol. I don't even know. Were you on patrol or you?
Yeah,
what were you
so
doing?
We were going out to take a cluster of compounds. So we were going out on a fighting patrol. Told to hunt the enemy and obviously remove the enemy. It's what it is. But I remember. I probably more remember the night. It was probably, I'd gone like 4 days without sleeping properly and like sporadic sleep. I was tired. Never been that tired in my life. I was low energy and sort of, it was like the only way to describe it is like the calm before the storm. Like, I slept that night and that was the weirdest thing. Like, and we slept in a compound that we'd taken over, 100% surrounded by the enemy. We knew they was like sitting in the bushes sleeping too. It was a case of we were going to wake up that morning. They were going to be in one area. So, we were going to be in the other.
I mean, just give me an idea of the proximity of the enemy. And is it almost like, okay, I'm going to sleep now, you're going to sleep now, and let's get up in an hour and do it.
These are gentlemen's agreement that went out in that summer, and that was in midday heat. We won't fight each other. We're British, like, we're used to rain. Like, we ain't going to be able to fight in midday Afghan heat in the summer. So, and the Taliban don't tend to fight in that because they can't hack it either. So you'd literally, it'd get to like 1, 2 p.m. and the world would just fall silent and everyone would just go to bed.
What did you think of the Afghans? I mean, you obviously fought alongside them and I guess against
Afghan
them.
Afghan National Army, the loosest people I've ever met, the most dangerous people I've ever met. Would I work with them again? No. Would I have an issue with working them in a normal job? Yeah. Not because I'm racist, just because I know the type of people that they are. They are badly cultured. Like, the soldiers are very badly cultured.
So, like, how much reliance did you have on these people to look after you? Or you look after them? Just give me the idea of the dynamic.
So my situation on that is different.
Okay.
Why it's different, why my views are because of an incident which will probably come out over the next couple of months, in terms of, like, that'll be published in the next couple of months. So I'm probably am the wrong person to ask on the Afghan side. Only because, due to a personal circumstance, I believe that they're the most evilest people on earth. That's not all Afghan people. The Afghan locals offered us tea and were the nicest people on earth. Afghan interpreter helped save my friend's life. Like, that's them. Afghan National Army, wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them. To the point where we had an active plan that if they were to turn on us, we'd be able to escape. We had a plan drawn out in the same building that they lived in, because that's how loose they were.
So that's really interesting. So how many Afghan National Army would you be working with, and how many of you would there be?
On the peak of Panther's Claw, we probably had a company, so maybe it was like 80, 90 of them. 34 of them were killed. 34 of them were killed.
34 Afghans?
Yeah. Just for stupid stuff, though. They'd walk out in the middle of a firefighter without putting the red down. They'd stand up when things are... They'd step on IEDs in stupid places that you could clearly see were IEDs.
So, just help me out here. Was the idea for you guys to train them up with the extra bodies?
No, there were teams that did train. There were teams that did train them. Our job was just to... There was going to come a point, and there is a point, where the British were just going to step away from the war and the Afghans would have to lead the fight. And you can't do that overnight. The Afghans, the Taliban were the most hardest people in the world.
Yeah.
Like, they've been fighting since before I was even born. And they'd happily stand on the roof and leave notes around saying that the things they were going to do to you, they were the hardest. Honestly, I've never met a guy who was as hard as a Taliban fighter. We captured some once, and they literally just looked at us dead in the eyes and in perfect English just went, There's nothing you can do to me that will make me fear you. Like, and I.
And did you believe them?
Yeah, yeah. Stone Cold looked at me in the eye and was like, nothing you can do I can make me fear you. And I was like, yeah, this guy's not scared. Can't win against an enemy that will run at you to die rather than put down his weapon. Like, and so he can't win against that. So the Afghan army, they knew that they couldn't win against them. A lot of the Afghan army were ex-Taliban fighters. So we had a lad who, he was actually probably an all right one. I got him right well. Like, and he had a tally chart on his arm from Russians he'd killed in the 80s.
Crikey, how old was he? Like in 60 or something?
So he was a Mujahideen fighter and then transferred across to the Afghan National Army when the area became occupied.
So, I mean, obviously the British troops must not like the Taliban very much. That's an understatement. You have issues with the Afghan National Army, but the Afghan National Army and the Taliban must despise each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that must be the real blood.
You've got to remember, but they have got also a lot of things in interest too. And that's what people don't realise is the Taliban have a lot of people, a lot of interests with the Afghan National Army. For example, they both like kids, don't they? Like, abusing children is quite common in their culture. Well, not their culture, that's the wrong thing. But, so, it's like unwritten rules, like the Taliban will go out in the evening and the Afghan Army, National Army would let it happen. Personally, us, we didn't like that. You're not here to mess with their culture, you're not here to mess with what they're doing.
And was that widespread?
Certainly happened in our area, happened in other areas of other fighters. British lads did respect the Afghan National Army, not for that, but some lads actually had good bunches of Afghan National Army soldiers. But for me, we didn't. We had a bad bunch. But then at the same time, the Taliban would.
So you must be on patrol, or you must be with these soldiers, and you must have the most complex set of interactions, because you don't know if they've got the shared interest, you don't know if they hate each other. I mean, you simply don't know. You don't know anything about these people.
They're unpredictable. They're worse than the Manchester weather. They're that unpredictable.
Wow.
Like, we weren't... So, obviously, if we had to stay in the same compound, we weren't allowed to unload our weapons because they were that unpredictable. Everywhere we went, we had to have a pistol on our our waist. Like,
to me, this is the point where I think a rational person would think, this is unwinnable. Because if we do our job well here and we step back and we leave it in the hands of these people, all this blood has been wasted.
So I was like...
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Stood on London Bridge. Is it London Bridge? Tower Bridge, when the Afghan War ended. And someone rang and was like, yeah, just let you know the Afghan War ended. And the area which we fought for was called Wishton. And he went and Wishton fell to the Taliban 24 hours after.
That must be crushing.
And I instantly threw up on Tower Bridge there. And then, like, and even sort of just the thought, like, is like, it's pretty minging. Like, it's not a nice feeling. But a lot of people back home would see it as a wasted thing. It's hard to do. It's a tough pill to swallow, that. Like I lost 10 lads fighting for that town. And
you lost 10 friends?
10 friends fighting for that town and stuff. And it's tough, isn't it? It is what it is. But no one's seen what was actually going on in that country. No one's seen how we once had a firefight in a village and we cleared that village of Taliban. And there was kids and women who were coming out of their compounds who had not been out of their compounds for 2-3 years because they had been under Afghan control, Taliban control. So, is it worth it? It's hard to say. Personally, I'd give my life so they could come out of that compound and live freely. Like, is that's your job, innit? You're not here. I'm not bothered about people's opinions back home when that's going on. People can have their opinion. I'm not bothered about that.
Again, and I guess that, I mean, like, I've got a lot of opinions on a lot of things. I kind of wish I didn't, though. But, you know, that must be another thing, which is people are given their opinions on conflicts, say, or, and they just mustn't have a clue about what really is going
on. How can you give an opinion, though, if you've not been surrounded by the enemy? Like,
exactly.
That's my view. Like, I'd say walk a mile in a soldier's shoes in 2009. Fact is, you wouldn't be able to walk a mile. We were moving at 100 metres a day, like, you won't be able to walk a mile and survive.
That's absolutely incredible. So, where did the military career end for you? It was with your injury.
Yeah, so obviously after I got hit, came through the recovery sort of process, the recovery sort of journey, and I did try to fight back to sort of get back to fitness, and it was just weren't happening, and it is what it is. Like, I've always had the theory, as long as I can walk, I can run. Like, but it was very evident that, like, my body just weren't taking, like, back to being a soldier. And there was other options. I got asked to go into the intelligence cell, and, like, I just couldn't sit in a room smaller than this with no windows, like, constantly. Like, it was just not for
looking me. Looking at photos or what have you.
Yeah, like, didn't need to see that, like. And then the option was to become a clerk. Now, in Northern Ireland, like, there's, like, two flights a night out of to Manchester. And this clerk used to always mess my flights around. And I used to water batter him every day. Like. So I just thought to myself, I can't become a clerk. I can't have lads coming up to me wanting to batter me because I've messed the flight up. So that was that option. And basically, the army are obviously going to make loads of cuts. And the biggest fear was that they could possibly, they wouldn't. But you never know that they'd cut a wounded soldier redundant, make a wounded soldier redundant. So they basically said, we'll medical retire, give you 75% of your salary for the rest of your life if you leave. And I was just like, well, I can't fight, so I don't want to be here. And that's pretty much how it ended. It ended on a car park in Preston, and the guy shook my hand and said, thanks for your service. And
wow.
Said, took my ID card off me, and it was done there. Yeah.
Crikey. Tell me about your injury. Tell me about that incident.
So we just standard patrol, just got hit, an ambush, an IED, bit of a firefight followed it. I'd lost sort of like, obviously I'd been wounded at that sort of point. And then obviously from that point of wounding, I was quite lucky, lucky in some aspects. But so like, I grew up like thinking Black Hawk helicopters were amazing, and the Chinook wouldn't come in and land because of the type of injury I had and the complex of the area. So the Black Hawk Pedros are called, the nickname's Night Stalkers.
Yeah.
They came in and got me, and it's like the ride of my life. Like, don't be wrong, I was blind at the time. I detached both my retinas and I'm flying on this Black Hawk. But,
oh my God.
I got to fly my helicopter. I wanted to do the whole time. I went to war so I could go on a Black Hawk. Like, that's the reality of it. So I got Black Hawked out, and pretty much, obviously, I went straight into, it was skeptical a few days, and then I ended up back in England and sort of woke up in a hospital. And I always joke, and Selly Oak Hospital was like a reunion. Like, we'd had that many casualties. Like,
oh my word.
It was like just seeing my mates again. And it was weird, don't get me wrong. Like, it was very weird. But one of the probably the more prominent memory sort of I have of that is being in this room in Selly Oak Hospital, and there's some woman approaching the door. And I remember looking at her thinking, she's fitter. Like, and it was my mate's mum, which is awkward. and she came in and basically was like, is that rifle with Monaghan? And someone in the room was like, yeah, it is. And I had dealt with a casualty a couple of weeks before being wounded, and he'd lost his leg. He was bleeding quite heavily. I dealt with him, and I could not hear from him. I didn't know the situation or anything. And his mum would come, and she just came in and gave me a hug and sort of thanked me and was like, we work for you. Like, my son won't be here now and stuff. So that was sort of probably a nice memory. I mean, Cadbury's World was just around the corner, and they sort of like give us 3 days out all the time. Now, our soldiers are not the most mature people in the world. So you send a bunch of us who were wounded and thinking the world owes us everything to Cadbury's World, like, we're going to fuck it up. And that's pretty much what we did.
Now, Cadbury's have got a lot of military tradition in them, have they not?
Yeah, so the son of the owner.
That's right, yeah.
So I've met him several times. It was weird. I was at a ball with him and he was like, no, I own Cadbury's. And I was like, no, you don't, mate.
No, I'm pretty sure, right? I'm pretty sure Cadbury's have a trust. And in order to gain access to the money in the trust, you've got to serve in the army. I'm sure that is the case.
That's interesting.
But I'll look that up. I'm absolutely sure.
I'm going to look that up. Like, we've got a forces programme to fund here.
yeah, exactly. I've lost my train of thought now. When you got hurt, had you been hurt before?
No, not like that, no.
So did you know immediately this is more serious? Was that instantly like, oh shit?
Laying in a ditch bleeding, yeah, I knew it was bad, yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it was bad.
I'm like, is there a pain? Is there a panic? Is it acceptance? What is it that you're feeling?
So I had my birthday coming up and I used to joke that. I didn't joke. No, that's the wrong thing. Everyone used to joke that I was going to get hit on my birthday. It's like a thing. Like, it was inevitable. I'd been involved in a lot of incidents. It was going to happen. It was definitely going to happen. My ears had been ringing for days, so I knew I was going to end up deaf anyway. It's hard to explain. Did I know it was going to happen? Subconsciously, yeah. Did I want it to happen? I mean, I was pretty hungry, so... I mean, got me fed, didn't it? Like, getting sent home. No, I wanted to see the war out. I wanted to return to Afghan. I wanted to bow in and bow out. I didn't want to get injured. Did I want to, like... I didn't want to get injured. I wanted to see the war out like a fighting man.
Yeah.
Certainly wanted to... If I were.
And
in a way, it's sort of sometimes it's easier to... It's easier to die at war than it is to come home injured.
I can imagine. Tell me, what are the effects of your injury? What's the long lasting legacy of this?
Anytime you'll see a photo of me, it's pretty much always taken from the right side. So my left arm's like slightly skinnier than my right. I have like some less usage in my left arm and stuff. Good job I'm not left handed, otherwise could be an issue.
Yeah.
Deafened and the traumatic brain injury, a bit of an issue with my brain and stuff, yeah. So they were probably they're the main injuries that were like that still bother me now. Mm-hmm. But then the biggest one, which is pretty much why we thought of the trust program, it's like called Balls to That, and it's because the trauma of that, not that day, that day was traumatic, but so was the other 100 odd days before it.
Yeah.
So the trauma of that caused a lot of mental health issues. I wouldn't say mental health issues. It left a lot of guilt.
Why guilt?
Because I survived, and that's the bottom line. Someone described it to me the other day. It's like, it's almost easy. Like, for me, if I was to walk in here, I was like, oh yeah, I got injured at war. You'd be like, oh right. You'd look me up and down, like, this is naturally what you do. And that does make you feel bad, like, but if you came in here and was like, oh, I lost someone at war, like, it's more understandable.
Yeah.
Being wounded isn't understandable, especially being wounded in the way I was. It's not that understandable. So you feel guilt for that. Afghan weren't an easy place. Like, war was glorified to me in my head, and it weren't what I thought it was. It was harder than what I thought it was. It weren't as cool as what I thought it was. And that played on me a lot. And certainly that's one thing we sort of talk about in, like, having a trauma-based mental health issue was like being reborn again. Mm. Like, I had to learn everything again. Like, I had to learn how to be a person again. I had to learn how to talk to people again. I had to learn how to find who I was.
Were you aware that you were acting strangely?
No, I thought everyone else had a problem. I openly, like, and that's one thing we say, and that's what we base the whole project around, is I felt every single person had a problem, and reality was I was the problem. And I thought everyone rolled around with a chip on a folder, but it was me. And I expected people to just understand.
And how was this first brought to your attention? Who was it that got hold of you and said, Craig, you know, this is you. It's not everyone else.
The first time someone told me I had an issue, I'd come back from New York. I'd been in New York for 5 days. I'd blew, best part, I'd blew probably over £12,000 in 5 days. And I came back and it was like not an intervention. I basically had to sign control of funds across.
Hang on a second. What did you spend £12,000 on?
Definitely can't go on this. I spent £12,000 just living my best life. And I came back and it weren't like an intervention, but they're like, you've got a problem, you're self-sabotaging yourself. Like, don't be wrong. They took all of my finances, invested in property and looked after it, like put something like a 10-year bond thing and and stuff like that.
Who are they? Who are the people helping you at this point? Like friends and family?
Friends. Yeah, so it was just friends. Like, no family were there. When I was wounded, they weren't no family.
Really?
Sister, that was it. Like, it was no family. But that didn't bother me. Like, it is what it is, isn't it? Certainly. So that was the first instance where someone said a problem. And then I think I was like 3 suicide attempts deep. And someone asked me, am I okay? And I went, do you know what, mate? No, I'm not. And I just unloaded heavily on this person. And the guy just listened. He didn't even say, look, mate, like, don't worry about it. The guy just was sound with me. Do you know what I mean? Like, he just looked after me like I didn't need a hug or anything. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, I struggled to hug my own child. Like,
yeah.
Like, emotion's not for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's, you know,
that's pretty much why Balls to That is probably so popular and stuff like that. And, like, one of the biggest of things is, like, Balls to That talk about, like, the mental health aspect, and that's why we're doing that. You've probably seen that an evening sort of battlefield to the rugby field is talking about that journey of how to deal with the mental health through sport and stuff. And that's pretty much is that. I was 3 suicide attempts deep, and I made a choice. I can let this kill me, and it was going to kill me. Like, I might have had skill fade on the whole trying to kill myself thing, but that's only because I was found, like.
So, one of the things which strikes me talking to you, despite everything that you've been through, you know, what happened in the army, the amount of firefights, the amount of friends that you've lost, you do still seem to love the army. You know, you see there's a certain fondness that sort of comes through. Is what you went through in the army what you struggled to come to terms with, or was it the actual leaving of the army which made you struggle?
So, I'm still fond of the army because the army did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
A lot of people barking at the minute. I say barking is because it's not true. And the army don't abandon people, like, and that's the moral of it. And it's something I get asked regular. The army didn't abandon me. I'm financially secure because of the army. I've got the values I've got because of the army. We've built a project because of the army. I'm a fond of the army. Yeah, the army fed me. It's good enough to take the pound. Good enough for me now, like, I'm fond of the army. My brother's died for I got injured doing it, so yeah, I'm fond of it. The system getting out, could it be better? Yeah. But could you be better at your job? You probably could. So everyone can always get better. The army could get better. You got to think, out of what we took, base it on 63 people, 10 dead, 26 injured. How do you look after them 26 who were getting out? Can't keep a tab on every single soldier. Some slip for the help. Ownership comes down to the soldier. That's why Sharks Forces is there.
Yeah.
Is when you're ready for help, like, we're there, we're going to pick you up, we'll sort you out. Like, that was the big thing, is it's not their fault. It's not the veteran's fault. System could be better, yeah, it could be. But that's that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about the criticism of the army, and I think, particularly in the media, there's a lot of, like, why are we not supporting people move, you know, transition, and so on and so forth. What do you think it is that people miss from the army? Because I don't think it's the skills. I think actually it might be more like the camaraderie and being around like-minded people.
People always bang on, like, saying, like, like literally what you just said, like the army could help with transition. The army do help with transition.
Yeah.
Sharks Forces is funded by the army's charity. That's the army's money that are paying for me to do my job to help soldiers. So that's paying for that bubble in theory. Because that's all we've done, is we just lifted that army bubble, we just moved it into Civilian Street, and we've created a military community on the outside. The difference is, you'll just go and sit in the AJ Bell Stadium on a weekend, and you watch those Sharks play with what soldiers call normal people, civilians. You'll do that. That's pretty much what that funding has done. It's going into a prison, it's helping lads who are serving, it's giving that military community on the outside, and because that's what's missed. That's what I miss. Every day I wake up and I miss the boys, like,
yeah,
it was a block party every weekend. Like it was, it's like even in Afghan, the best times of my life were with lads in Afghan. Like the best times of my civilian life were with lads at home. Like you look at my friend circle over in sort of like Vicky, Jack, Georgie, like who were normal. You look at Bowden when I'm playing at Bowden. The lads I'm hanging around with from that club are the lads who were served. The lads I hang around with outside of the Jack, the Georgie, Vicar, our lads who were served. Like, yeah, we're like glue, and it don't matter what cat badge they are, is you get each other, like, it's all right. Like, and that's pretty much what is missed in the military. People miss their friends.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and that's why the army takes so much stick.
So, I'm not saying it's easy, but I almost imagine the easy part for the army is to say, here's some qualifications and here's a course and, you know, hey, we'll do whatever we can, we'll spend whatever we can. But actually what they can't recreate is exactly that. It's the camaraderie.
So the army's contract is they're not allowed to leave you in a worse off than they found you.
Yeah.
And they don't. But what they can't do is they can't go, right, what we'll do is we'll give you the 12 lads you live in a flat with.
Yeah.
And send them home with you. Like, you can't do that. Like, and what people do forget is, certainly in the National Regiment, the big regiments, we're not local. We're spread from Newcastle all the way down to Exeter.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So, my section were spread. I was, the closest lad I had lived to me was, I think it was like Sheffield. It was the closest lad, which is kind of
close. I've never even thought about that.
So, he's that far spread. So, you're going to lose that military connection. But then the ownership's on you to make friends. That's why rugby's there. That's why football's there. Like, every single infantryman has played rugby at some point. So, that's why we're going to build this sevens team, we're going to build this rugby team, we're going to get playing, we've got Sharks Forces, we've got this dog walking, we've got, you name it, like we've got it, and if we haven't got it, we're going to build it, like, because we know the gap's there. I know it's missing, I miss it. It does me wonders having this job. Like, I just get to hang around and drink coffee with lads who are served, and it's the most brutal banter in the world, but I'll take it. Like, I'd take that over, I don't mean in a disrespectful way, I'll take that over sitting and having coffee with normal people.
Yeah.
At least normal people, some normal people get me, like, but...
Well, I know that I'm enjoying this interview more than most, so, yeah, you know, it makes sense. So, for lads leaving the forces then, how important do you think it is that, you know, you get re-established with another group of people? And actually, just linking that onto rugby, you know, were you playing rugby when you were in the army? Was it like a passion of yours, or did you fall into it afterwards?
I played rugby so I could go home. I played rugby in
Explain
the army.
Explain that to me.
So at 16 years old, I was in Harrogate, and it was like an intercompany competition coming up. I'd been running cross country. I was like a little whippersnapper, like quite quick. Had good hamstrings. So I always joke about hamstrings. I had good hamstrings. And there's this rugby competition coming up, and I was like, never played rugby before. Went to this guy, his name Rob Hurst. He was like team leader person, and he was like, yeah, come play rugby, you get a long weekend off. It's like, could do with going home. It's just been payday. Like, the army loves spending money on payday. Like, could do with going home. Whole 660 quid. I was like, I'll go and blow that in Manchester on a weekend. So I was like, don't know what to do. He goes, you're pretty quick. All you got to do is catch a ball and run.
Like, and where was this game?
In Harrogate.
So, and who were you playing?
The other companies at Harrogate. So there's like four or five training companies. We'd all have different teams, and we'd just play against each other. And I sort of remember, like, 2 minutes into the first game, ball came out to the wing, I caught it, and ran the full length of the pitch, and I was like, yeah, this is quite enjoyable.
I've actually played the police once, and I actually played for the fire brigade. Never been a fireman, FYI. And they were they were brutally violent. I just thought, like, this is a product of them having to go around, deal with scumbags every day, and now they're going to take it out on some firemen. What is the feel on intercompany rugby? Because I imagine that's going to be a little bit different.
Lucky enough, we were all recruits, so we weren't even real soldiers by that point. So,
oh, this is just training
yeah,
company,
so we were
right?
Just training
okay,
companies, and we were just so it was just to, like, drop a shoulder on people. To be fair, like, I'm sure, like, people will tell you now, like, I don't make many tackles as it is now, so I definitely weren't going to make any tackles then. So I sort of all I did was literally my job was to finish. Like, I literally the lads would shout on the pitch, like, pass the ball to create, like, pass the ball, Money, I was calling, pass the ball to Money, let him run. And that's pretty much how it sort of started, which is sort of quite funny. You flash forward to now, and
yeah.
Vicky was at a game a couple of months ago where everyone was shouting the same, pass the ball to Craig and he'll run. So I did something right because I'm here now, and I sort of obviously kicked on from that, and that's pretty much how rugby began. Obviously, it stopped after Afghan. I was told you won't play rugby again, but that then gave me more meaning. I'm a soldier. Like, you tell me I can't, I'm going to show you I can, and that's just my mentality. Like, I go back to that winning mentality. Like. Yeah. And that's pretty much where it kicked on.
Now, I think at this point, before the interview, we had a little chat and a name came up. I'd like you to just say a little bit about this. A guy called Dave Murray, who I've actually trained with. He's helped coach Didsbury Toc H. Just tell me about that connection.
So, yes, Dave Murray had served a long time in the military. He had quite a vital role. An important role. I know he definitely don't like it being public, but he did have a very special role within the military. Obviously, 37 year career. It's
37 years.
It's respectable. Like, his first war was like 80s or something. Like, and then his last war was Afghan. So, sort of gives that scope of how big it was. And he sort of approached me. Our paths crossed in previous times. Obviously, he'd been heavily involved in Navy rugby, and I'd been involved with Army rugby, and our paths crossed. And when he knew I was sort of on the scene, and I was sort of like looking for a club or whatnot, and I needed looking after, so to speak. Like, I don't get me wrong, like, I'm the type of guy, I'll go to like a sort of England, like I'll go sort of to like an England F training camp or whatever, and I'll stay up late on purpose so I sleep in and try and miss getting down there, like, and stuff. So Dave Murray was aware of this.
So it's funny you mentioned that, right? This sounds so stupid. But back in the day when I used to get very, very excited about playing, I still do get excited about playing, I used to stay up really late on Fridays, so I'd sleep in on Saturdays, so I'd less time from waking up to playing rugby, because otherwise I'd be too excited to play rugby. Like, it's just stupid stuff.
See,
like
I'd do it just so I didn't have to.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, I get, like, quite, like, nervous. Not for games, because I'm who I was before I got injured. I was who I was before I got off the island and playing, and that's, like, no hidden thing, but one of the biggest things sort of I had was that I was a ticking time bomb, so to speak, and Dave Murray identified that very early on and was like, right, come to Clay Lane and we'll look after you and stuff. And they have done, like, bearing in mind, like, I'm a deaf person playing in an able-bodied team.
Yeah.
I'm a person with a brain injury playing in an able-bodied team. A person who was told you would never play rugby again playing in an able-bodied team. A person... he's got a dodgy arm. He drops his shoulder in quite regular. Whether that's late or not, that's a different story. So I'm that person. And he identified all that. And he made sure that the club, I didn't change my way I played. The club mm-hmm. changed the way they played to adapt to me. So the calls became shorter so I could understand them.
That's amazing.
He made sure the fullback passed the message on if I was out on a wing. He made sure the 10 signed the message to me if I was at 9. And then that was sort of emulated when Byron and Josh took over. Byron made it even more easier. Obviously, like, we have a good relationship, and he just made it more simpler for me, made it more simple for them. Called it Things I'd Know. Named everything after a weapon, so it would get easier. And that was sort of, he just adapted that. I'm not going to go into the exact calls, because
I am actually taking notes here.
Yeah, because
we've got Bowden pre-season.
Yeah, I've heard. So that's pretty much.
Well, good guy.
Yeah, so Dave Murray took me under his wing, which is then sort of very closely replicated by Josh and Byron's passion for it, which is always good. And then sort of on the England side, the England head coach is very heavily involved with the military and stuff, and he just makes sure I'm looked after.
Yeah, so we just need to touch on that a little bit more, I think, because you sort of mentioned it, but we've not really told the listener exactly what you mean there. It's not just Bowden that you play for.
No, it's not. So, yeah, so I'm obviously very fortunate to sort of obviously represent my country with England Deaf and stuff, so sort of I've been involved in that setup now for a couple of years, and that's just sort of growing. Started off as like the third choice, sort of fourth choice, not even getting game time, to sort of being sort of the first choice now, which is it's quite decent.
And how often are you guys playing?
We're getting quite a lot of fixtures. We've got Wales coming up in April, which is going to be good. It's going to be busy. No one likes the Welsh anyway, so.
Well, in full disclosure, my only ever representative rugby game was for the Welsh Deaf team. For one appearance, because he didn't have enough players when I was 19.
See?
There you go.
There we go. Yeah. It's growing, the sport's growing, the funding's growing, the sponsorship's growing, everything's just growing, and it's sort of, again, I've added value to that, so since I've sort of joined, like, I'm obviously aware we just ended a war, like,
yeah.
A lot of lads with hearing issues.
Is it a lot of military lads that are there?
So we've had an 80, since I've pushed it in the military channels through Sharks Forces, through whatever I can get my hands on. We've had an 80% increase in forces personnel, which is massive.
Yeah, it really is. I guess it helps in multiple ways. It's not just helping the team, but actually...
I just want soldiers around me. Like, so.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
I mean, I just want to...
Take it over.
And drink with my mates, like...
So what is the role Sail Sharks has in all this? I mean, how has it come to be the Sail Sharks forces? I know the Army pays for some of it. Sail Sharks support it in some way. How does it all kind of mesh?
Other than being pretty supportive of me. no, the serious side of it is that they identified a gap in the area.
Yeah.
No one really... There was people doing stuff, but no one was doing it to a grand scale. They've seen that the military sport is rubber. Being the only premiership team in the area, they've seen that it was definitely sort of an advantage to them. And even though, like, City United have dabbled in it and people were bang on about other initiatives in the area, but no one's really doing it like we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And people, we came on with an idea that it'd be workshops and we'll get people all singing and dancing. Then we came up with the idea we're going to be a community, and that's pretty much what we have done. And that's where the trust has banged on in terms of the numbers it's helped. We don't fabricate anything. Our numbers are legit. Like, we make sure that in order for us to bring the veteran into our circle, like, it's, you need to be trusted, so everyone else needs to trust you. So we're not going to not verify that you are a real veteran. The last thing we want is someone who's not a real veteran showing up. And
does it happen?
Oh, yeah. It has happened. We've had other people try it. But it's harder because of who I am. Like,
yeah.
How do you come and fake being a soldier to the person who is me? Like, you can't. It's hard. I'm wrong, but people have tried. But we have a good verification process. And we have a good support network. So we won't throw you in a group. We'll meet you one-to-one off-site or at Carrington. We'll meet you there. We'll chat to you. We'll see where you're at. We'll see whether you're ready for a group. Don't be wrong, people tip up all the time to activities. That's mm-hmm. the beauty of the activities which we've got running. Obviously, the coffee afternoon on a Tuesday and then the two walking things on a Tuesday morning and a Thursday afternoon. We get them tipping up to that. That's fine. But certainly, if you need help, a lot of people are not going to turn around in a circle of people or walking around a pond that they need help. So we sit that. And we've been we're quite lucky being who we are that we have got the links in the area. There's other initiatives out there who are banging their drum, but the difference is they're not to us. Is we're taking over, and that's something we are pretty proud of. We are banging our drum in the right way.
Is that sort of part of that military competitiveness?
It's not. It's just the fact that we know what we're doing, and that is the broadness. Like, I'm sure if you ask any member of the trust,
yeah,
what we're doing, they'll tell you the same. We're doing it right. That's not a pop at anyone in particular either. Like, we're confident in what we're doing. Like, we're going to go into a prison. We're going to get...
Yeah, tell me about that. That's amazing. How has that come about?
So, the community development manager, she's just sort of keen in absolutely everything.
community development manager who is
Vicky Irwin.
Vicky, who is actually sitting right in front of us right now.
Yeah, so she's keen at everything. Obviously, she's been in a job a long time, starting with like on the rugby side, doing disability stuff. So obviously, she's got a lot of links. And a guy who used to work for Saracens knows Vicky. They got chatting. Next thing we know, he started working in a prison in Berwyn prison. He's got a military wing, and it just made sense.
Sorry, they've got a military wing. Sorry, just to be clear, a military wing, is that for ex-servicemen who are locked up, or is that for current servicemen locked up?
So a lot of them have gone from military prison to civilian prison because they've got long serve. They've had long sentences.
So that's a soldier under sentence.
Yeah, yeah. So and then they've been discharged and then transferred to a civilian prison.
So if you do, is that for a civilian crime or an army crime?
Can be either.
Oh wow! So you do a couple of years there, and then you go off to.
Yeah, so you do. I think you're only allowed to do a year and a half in Colchester, and then you get sent to a civilian prison. But ultimately, if you leave Colchester, you are getting discharged. So all these lads are waiting to come into the system. Majority will be relocating to the northwest or locating back to the northwest. And the conversations we went down, met him, spoke, went on to this wing. And it's the most bizarre thing ever. Like, it's what you expect a prison to be. The only thing is, it's quite scary. Like, I wouldn't say I was, like, fearing for my life, but I was like, wow, this is an uncomfortable place. Like,
wow.
These are like, I'm a hard man, but obviously prison, they are hard people, aren't they? Like, I mean, you've got to last in that environment. So we went in, me and Vicky went in, had a meeting, and it was an amazing facility, brand new prison. And when we went in, got chatting, we actually spoke to some of the prisoners on this wing. Lad who had served, who'd all had happened to him, he just wrong place, wrong time sort of situation. I know everyone says that, but by the sounds of it, this guy really was just, and he's leaving with no qualifications, no transition really. And that's where we basically built a 107-page booklet on how to transition to civilian street. And we're going to take that in, work through it over 21 weeks. Working with him for 21 weeks, us working alongside the prison service. And after that 21 weeks, they'll get like a little certificate, a nice graduation day. The families will come in and see that they've achieved something in that 21 weeks. And they'll meet myself and Vicky and India, who are all sort of like based around this project. And we'll hopefully they'll then kick on into civilian life with the transition. And Shaq's Forces will be there for them on the outside. Help them with housing if they need it. Help it with the benefits if they need it. Help them get a job if they need it. Help them with their mental health if they need it.
What do you think the biggest misconception is of veterans from the public? If indeed there is one.
We're all raging killers. Like, but that's the biggest thing. Everyone thinks that every one of us have fought, and everyone thinks that every one of us have killed someone. And that's couldn't be further from the truth. You think not that many people have actually fought the enemy.
Yeah.
And there's a billion different jobs in the military. And that's probably the biggest conception.
And for lads coming out then, we sort of touched on it, you know, being away from your mates and the institution of the military. Like, what other things do you find most helps with them, like on just practical levels?
Sure, Vicky would probably say the biggest thing we have is underselling ourselves. Like, I don't bang on about my achievements, I don't bang on about who I am, or I don't bang on about anything really. If anything, I don't actually accept what I've done or what I've achieved or anything. And that's the biggest thing. A soldier won't sell himself to a job. He don't know how to apply for a job. Like, he's only army. It's not like an interview, like, oh, can you do this, can you do that? It's, what have you got, let's go.
Yeah.
And it's just changing that attitude to a civilian attitude. And we don't have all the answers at Sharks Forces. We've got the majority of them. And if we ain't, we're working with partners who have got all the answers. So
tell me about your partners. Who
we've been working with over the past, obviously the Army's charity, so the Soldiers Charity, or the Army Benevolent Fund is known more publicly. They're one of the biggest partners. Walking with the Wounded helped us. British Legion have helped us in the past. Things like housing wise, obviously Walking with the Wounded being biggest houses, Stepford Housing being big housing place. Mawson, obviously it helps that the owner of Mawson is co-owner of this club. They're really keen with us. Just simple links. Prison service, obviously, with this new project, really great.
Yeah, I mean,
help.
I can't imagine how important that is. Not even so much for the individuals involved, but you know, more on a societal level. You want these guys coming out and doing something,
which is the big thing, and that's probably where like Vicky's coming. She's obviously been involved in all levels of sport and all levels of the job. Mm. And I've only really got the army to sort of back me up with the army rugby and a decent sport recovery story, so to speak. And sort of, so that's that sometimes I get annoyed at, sometimes I get annoyed with the way the outside is towards veterans. And then I get pulled aside and it's like, nah, look, like, if we do it like this, then this is how it'll unfold. And so it's sort of nice that's probably just been a vital sort of thing. Because we're all going to have challenges in what we do. And a civilian has challenges. The difference is to a civilian and a soldier is a soldier knows what he's doing with life. He knows how to win. He just needs to put that into a civilian context.
Yeah.
And that's where what we will do. The prison project will have its different challenges because obviously they're coming out with criminal records.
I mean, that is a really, really tough challenge.
It's going to be a great challenge, though, because if we can get this right, 2 21-week projects signed, a book, like an actual booklet, a worksheet, a full education, 107-page booklet that's been written, checked about 1,000 times, printed off about 1,000 times and binned 1,000 times. It's probably been the hardest thing. Like, it sounds stupid, but writing a booklet has probably been my hardest challenge, is actually getting the blueprint of my transition and veterans that we've dealt with, say 83 veterans over the last 12 months, their blueprints, our blueprints, where we've gone wrong, collating it all and then going, this is how we can do it for a prison. So that's been a challenge on its own. So to get this first 21 weeks out of the way from April onwards is going to be the biggest challenge. But I'm a soldier, like, I'm used to having the odds against me. So
yeah,
it's just another part of that journey. And
well,
is there
going to
be failures? Probably there is. Do you know what I mean? You can't get it right for 20 people in one or 30 in one.
Well, I mean, at least you're eating more than 1,000 calories a day in this job.
Exactly, and I get to go home every night, so
yeah,
so that's lucky. And I think the biggest thing about it all is we're aware of our failures. Like, any charity that says they've not got it wrong with a beneficiary are absolutely lying.
Yeah.
We openly go, we've got it wrong. Got it wrong with more than one veteran. But that's not because we don't know what we're doing. That's because sometimes it's about putting
complex.
Your hand up and going, this person's too complex for us to fix, but this person can. We're not afraid to signpost. My view, which has been emulated across the trust, is I don't care where the veteran gets the help, as long as they get the help. And that's what Sharks Forces is about. It's about helping the veteran get from point A to point B, whether it's with us or with someone else.
If you were to look ahead, say 3 years' time, where would you expect this project to be?
In every single prison in England. Where do we expect the project to be? In every single Premiership club in England with the Sharks' brand on it.
And, every single Premiership club in England with
obviously they can't have sell Sharks with me.
Yeah.
That's obviously, but where we want it is want it rolled out, not just in Premiership rugby. We want it rolled out. Like, there's no reason, we don't need Premiership rugby clubs to do it. We can do it, the trust can do it itself.
I mean, the brand
helps.
Yeah, rugby obviously massively helps and so on and so forth. But I mean, I guess any grouping where you can attract people in who, you know, then can create a community.
Well, we're in a prison in Wrexham.
Yeah.
There's prisons in Manchester. We're going to...
Are you having any luck with Premier Rugby or...?
Yeah, they're really good. Yeah, they've been really good. Everyone's been quite helpful. Wasps have asked us for help on their project, setting up one. Saracens have looked at it like we're banging the right drums, we're helping the right people. Are we bothered about what they're doing now? Probably not. Like,
And just a word, another word on the partners. Who are you looking to work with outside of sports teams? Like, are you looking for
anyone that wants to?
Is it private business or
anything? Yeah, it doesn't have to be sport. A lot like people. We need people who identify veterans in their workplace.
Yeah.
And if they've got them, we can come in and have a chat with them. Not saying they don't need to be struggling.
Yeah.
We had a veteran last year who didn't struggle at all until he'd been working with us for like 12 weeks and then he's gone, oh wow, I actually have a bit of an issue here, I'm a bit isolated or whatever. Like, veterans fall in the routine of getting up, going to work, coming home, going to bed. You can't do that. That's just the bottom line of it. You've got to have more to your life than that. Because that's what the military is.
Yeah, well, you mentioned something really interesting. I don't think you mentioned it on mic, actually. But, like, when you leave, you sort of get a bit lazy because you're not being told what to do.
That's pretty much why we started the dog walks. 75% plus is the thing when you leave the military. So when you leave, a lot of us become lazy. We've been told to get up for 7 a.m. and train every day. And we can't do that, do you know what I mean? Do that. Like it, one of the things, reasons I don't shave is because I've been told to shave every day in my life. The only reason I keep it groomed is because I think work would actually be annoyed if I looked a bit homeless. Like,
yeah.
But fitness just drops off. People become lazy. So what we aim to do is to not become lazy. So we've put on dog walks. So it's low impact. It's getting out in the fresh air first thing in the morning, early afternoon. It's walking around. It's talking to each other. It's just being who you are. And it's a laugh. You can bring your dog as well, which is even fun. Like,
yeah. Tell me, listen, if I'm a business owner or someone who thinks I can help, how can we help?
You drop me an email at craig.monahan@selfsharks.com and I'll happily have a conversation with you. Because sometimes it's just about letting links.
Yeah.
British Gas is a prime example. British Gas had a lad who came onto the Sharks Forestry programme, was working for British Gas. He just came for a coffee. I don't beat around. He literally was like, let's link up for a coffee. And he's now the Armed Forces Champion for British Gas in the Northwest.
Yeah.
And he's identified 9 veterans that he was working with and didn't realise. I've gave him some tips to sort of thing, and he checks in every now and then. Like, it's just links like that. It's not even, you don't even have to have veterans. You might have a job that veterans have a lot to offer the workplace. Like, the best thing about a veteran is we will find the quickest but best way to do something.
Mm.
Like, that's just who we are. Don't get me wrong, I drag my feet at a lot of things, but that's because of fatigue easy now. Like, I'm not this young 18-year-old super elite soldier now. I'm a 28-year-old wounded wannabe rugby player sort of guy. Like, and that's so, but that's why we put the dog walks on, get people out, get people active.
That's awesome.
And then there's other things, like, we obviously, like, a lot of people, like, what we are looking for sort of, like, business wise is obviously the trust have got hundreds of projects. Well, not hundreds, but we've got a lot.
Yeah.
We're creating waves in the Northwest, and that's what we aim to do. But, like, things, so, like, obviously with the balls, so that thing that I mentioned earlier, the workshops, we come into work business, we've gone into businesses that have no military links. So it goes in with me and a lad who got injured in rugby, who got down whilst he was off injured, talks about how his mental health was affected. And then we go into my journey, my story, quite intensely, and then we talk about stats, figures, ways to counteract that, ways you can make your workplace a better place mentally, and how you can support employers if you do have staff. Mental health now is so in the public eye. It'd be wrong of a company not to address it. And that's what Ball Stats for, is to provide that platform of how your staff can feel comfortable talking about it, how you can understand it more, and how my mindset worked to get to where I am now. And that's not to say I don't have bad days. Everyone in the trust will tell you some days. Like, yesterday I didn't speak to anyone. I actually snapped at someone, like, bit at people, like, and some days I can't even get out of bed and go in.
Yeah.
But for every bad day, there's about 10 good days. It's about managing it.
Yeah.
And that's what Ball Stat does. It teaches you how to manage it. Have we got all the answers? We'll never will. But it's a project worthwhile. And that's sort of like probably why we put on that an evening with me, where it goes from battlefield to the rugby ground. And it's a Q&A. It's a chance for people to come down, chat, hear the story, speak to me. Say speak to me, it sounds really cheesy.
I think anyone who's listened to this will invariably definitely want to speak with you. Do you know what, Craig? I think I'm gonna leave it there. I am absolutely delighted that you're sharing your story. I think it's gonna make a huge difference.
It's nice to obviously get it out on like a different platform. It's been a long journey to sort of get to a point where I feel comfortable talking, and yeah, like, do I like all the cheesy sort of media stuff? Then no, but
you're gonna have to deal with this, I'm afraid.
I deal with it. I get it, but it's not about me now. It's about helping other people, and I think that's what this provides me with, that platform. And like, it's a chance to sort of like get out of trackers and
so
put some jeans on.
Just remind us of your email for people to get in touch.
So it's craig.monahan. So Monahan's MONAGHAN. @sailsharks.com.
And we can also follow your rugby exploits on Twitter at
Craig_Monahan, and then the Sharks Trust. No.
Craig, thank you so much. Vicky, thank you too. That was really quite inspiring. So if you're out there and you think you can help Sell Shocks Forces Trust in any way, or you want to follow Craig, or you want to help out with Vicky, just get in touch on the channels that we mentioned before. Once again, guys, thank you so much.
Me and Byron will see you in pre-season.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.